Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back to our third installment of Breakfast in the Beast. We had a little bit of a hiatus. We had to cancel the last one before Pesach, and then Purim, Pesach, whatever, everything. So we're here now, May 26th, to finally discuss Nechama Leibowitz. Everyone has a packet? Hopefully everyone.
We need one more, yeah.
I don't have any more.
Oh, but yes!
Because I knew there were extra on this table. Okay, so we're going to spend the next, hopefully, hour or so discussing the Nechama Leibowitz. And what you'll find is that the model of Nechama Leibowitz is really unlike anything that we have discussed before, probably unlike many things that we will discuss in the future. And the reason, quite simply, without dancing on the topic, is that she's a woman, right? You very rarely, unfortunately, very unfortunately, is one of the terrible things that we have to deal with nowadays that, God willing, we are working on as a national, international Jewish community, and that is to create larger female Talmidei Chachamim. But she was really one of a kind in that, yeah, there were just... you'd be hard out to find anyone else who could sort of fit into this category, really, in Jewish history. And even in the last 100 years, again, you really can't find anyone else like her. Probably the most glaring difference between Nechama Leibowitz and all the other people that we have discussed so far, and like I said, God willing, we'll discuss in the future, is that obviously we refer to Rabbi Soloveitchik as Rabbi Soloveitchik, or the Rav. We refer to Rav Kook as Rav Kook, or HaRav. When it comes to Nechama Leibowitz, we'll call her Nechama, and everyone should be aware that we are not doing this out of disrespect. Rather, she was very upfront with her students that she wanted to be called nothing else but Nechama. So that's what we will refer to her as well, in honor of how she liked to be called. Now, there was a beautiful article that was written in Jewish Action, actually just this past winter, in the winter 2018 issue, about Nechama Leibowitz. So I thought we would just get started by reading a few snippets from this article to just sort of give us a general picture into seeing who she was, the impact that she made, and God willing, we'll go from there to go on with her whole biography, her whole life story, and God willing, learn some of her Torah. Take a look at source number 1 on page 2. So again, this is the article from Jewish Action. The article is called Queen of Questions, Nechama Leibowitz. So it says, on a torrid Jerusalem summer day in 1994, a package wrapped in brown paper was handed to Dr. Nechama Leibowitz while she was sitting shiva for her brother, Professor Yeshayahu Leibowitz. It had been sent her via airmail from the U.S. The variegated crowd that had come to pay condolence calls strained to see what was in it. The package contained several hundred condolence letters from the campers and staff at Camp Morashah, a modern Orthodox sleepaway camp. Rabbi Saul Berman, the camp rabbi who had attended Nechama Shiurim some time earlier while in sabbatical in Jerusalem, had told him about Nechama and had incorporated her methodology into the camp learning program. For better or for worse, Nechama Leibowitz really, she was known in America, but obviously she lived in Israel, and so she was not able to have the impact that was possible because she had not been in America giving Shiurim on a regular basis like she was in Israel. But because there were so many educators and people that were impacted by her Torah in the land of Israel, so in America there were many people who knew of her and were connected to her because, in this example over here, Rabbi Saul Berman was connected to her, and that's how people began to form some sort of a relationship with her, at least on some level, whether or not she was aware of it, unclear, but people began to become followers of her, again, just not as high in numbers in America as they were in Israel. We continue, when he suggested that the campers and counselors write short condolence letters, there was an outpouring of sentiments, variations on the theme. My mother went to your shiurim when she spent a year in a university in Israel, and she said they inspired her to become a Hebrew school teacher. My husband, a rabbi, uses your books and Gilead questions in almost all the shiurim he gives. What was it about Nechama's approach to Bible study that enabled her to impact thousands in the diaspora and tens of thousands in Israel, be they lay people, teachers, rabbinic scholars, academics, soldiers, or kibbutznikim? Her students came from across the Jewish spectrum, secular, traditional, and Orthodox, even including some Haredim. In the following article, we will respect her preference to be addressed sans any honorifics. Although she was professor of education in Tel Aviv University and laureate of the Israel Prize, Israel's highest form of recognition, Nechama's main preoccupation was the development of an active approach to study in general, and to Torah study in particular. In an essay she wrote in 1943, she lamented the passivity that sometimes characterizes those who study a text without a mentor. The problem is not that people misunderstand what is written, but rather that students think they understand when actually they don't. If a person does not understand a word or expression, The person will immediately realize it. But if the words do not ostensibly present any problems and the sentences are clear, everything will seem simple and the students will think there is nothing here that I do not understand. That it is exactly the misunderstanding. The student does not realize the innovation or what the verse is telling us or what idea the verse is opposing. The student does not realize that there are questions embedded here. Passivity during lectures worried her. Nachama Leibowitz was very known for her very, very interactive learning style, and such that if anyone was not paying attention or gave the impression that they weren't paying attention, or even if they, you know, stood there as some people, you know, every student, some students are better actors, some students are worse actors. So you look around, whenever I give a share, you see people who are like really trying to pay attention and really trying to make it look like they are, and like I know they're not. And some people are really, really good at it, and I think they are, but truth is they're not paying attention either. So Nachama Leibowitz was a master at this, at identifying who was totally present and who was not totally present. If you were not totally present, then you have to watch out, because her main concern was that when she would have a student that looked like they weren't paying attention, she's like, what are you doing here? Either get out of my class, and again, in a respectful way, don't be here, or be here and really be here. That's what she was all about, this passivity. And nowadays, of course, you know, many of us are aware of, whether it be through our children as students or as being teachers, some of us in this room are teachers, I've seen that in the past, that passivity that a student could have was the most horrifying thing to her. So these things worried her. One, going back to the article, one young woman would regularly doze off during shiurim, but it turned out that she was a laundress who worked the night shift. That was understandable. Nachama considered it laudable that the laundress made the attempt to attend shiurim during the day. What irked Nachama greatly were those who slept in class with their eyes wide open. This passivity that characterizes listening to lectures as well as text study leads people to think that they can learn effortlessly without exertion, without a spiritual struggle with the text. The most salient aspects of Nechama's methodology centered on four stages or steps. We'll just read the beginning words in 1-4. The Koshia write the question. She was all into her questions. We'll see as we continue how Nechama's methodology can be sort of summed up really in just that one line of how she was all about saying there's a question on everything. There is not one thing that cannot really be questioned on some level, shape, or form. And if you don't see a question, that means you really just did not understand it. There's always a question there. Number two, once a student had pinpointed the difficulty in the biblical passage, the second stage is to identify the essential differences between one parshan and another, right? Some people make a mistake and say, oh, you know what? It looks like over here, when you read a Rashi and a Ramban on a certain pasuk, it looks like they're agreeing. Maybe a Ramban like doesn't totally agree, but more or less they're saying the same thing. If someone would tell Nechama something like that, again, it could happen that Rashi and Ramban really do agree. But more often than not, there is a slight nuance, right? Why would the Ramban write a whole commentary when Rashi wrote a whole commentary? Because there has to be a difference between them. So anyone who makes the mistake to say that the Ramban is basically saying the same thing as Rashi would disgust Nechama. What are you talking about? Have you really actually learned the Ramban? Of course he says something totally different. He hates Rashi's opinion. But again, the only way you could really see that or understand it, even though they say similar things, is if you learned them properly, fully in depth. Number three, in the third stage, Nechama might ask, what are the pluses and minuses of this particular solution, right? Of course, there's always a pro and a con to every answer that's given by one of the Perushim, right? When Rashi says something, he's obviously answering the question from his perspective, but there could be failings in that, and the same is true with any other Perush. And finally, four, lastly, Nechama would ask, what meaning does this biblical verse and commentary have for us? She was also not just someone who was totally dedicated to the text itself, but rather, how is this text applicable to our lives? So that, with that, I find it appropriate that we read that article, because I just happened to have seen it just by accident, knowing that I was going to be speaking about Nechama Leibowitz. I saw it and I thought it was just a beautiful introduction into her life. This is who Nechama was. She was a teacher par excellence. It'll be hard to find anyone, male or female, who was as masterful as an educator as she was. Someone who cared about her students so much. Someone who was unbelievably humble. And someone who made as large of an impact as she was for being a woman. Again, I apologize for saying it like that, but that's the world that we live in, right? Women in the Torah world usually it's a contradiction in terms, but she was someone who sort of defied all odds and was able to become one of the greatest Torah scholars of our time. So now, in 1905, Nechama Leibowitz, we're outside of the source here right now. In 1905, Nechama Leibowitz was born. She was born on September 3rd and the 3rd of Elul. She was born in Riga, Latvia. She was 2 years older than she had a brother who was 2 years older than her. We mentioned Yeshayahu Leibowitz. Has anyone ever heard of Yeshayahu Leibowitz before? Okay, some people have, some people haven't. Those of you who had, what's so interesting about him?
I thought he was such a secular person who was deep philosophical concepts of Israel and the land, and she is apparently the impression being much more Haredi or more religious than me.
Okay, good. So, number one, I wouldn't necessarily define Nechama as Haredi, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. In terms of her brother was probably one of the more controversial figures of the 20th century, and that is because his perspective on theology, they were both Orthodox. If you would have asked Yeshayahu Leibowitz if he kept halacha, if he was a frum Jew, he would have, of course, said yes. But his perspective on Judaism theologically was very problematic, at least according to the Orthodox theology that we have developed in our day and age. And as a result, he sort of became a more avant-garde thinker. He's studied more by philosophers, you know, in universities, more than he studied by from Jews in Batei Midrashot, just because of the fact that he really not only contributed more to the philosophy world, but also because of the fact that he just had these opinions in Shittot that seemed to be outside of the main framework of Orthodoxy as we see nowadays. However, that said, Nechama was obviously aware of some of the opinions of her brother, but they really did have a beautiful relationship. Before we discuss their relationship, actually, you know what, let's discuss their relationship first, and then we'll speak for a few more moments about Yeshayahu Leibowitz. So take a look at source number 3. So you'll see many of the sources that we have here are from the book Nechama Leibowitz, Teacher and Bible Scholar by Yael Unterman. It's probably one of the best biographies that's out there on Nechama Leibowitz. It's very comprehensive. It's about 600 pages long. If you really come out of this one-hour synopsis of her life and you feel like you really want to know more, I would recommend buying that book, or you could borrow it from me as well. It was Rena's book before we got married, so we could trade it. But feel free to come over and borrow it as well. So take a look at source number 3. Extraordinary siblings. Professor Uriel Simon likens Nechama and Yeshayahu Leibowitz and their scope and influence to two of Rashi's illustrious grandchildren, Rabbeinu Tam and Rashbam. Like them, the Leibowitz siblings between them conquered the Jewish world. Their combined impact on Israeli and Jewish society, too immense to measure. It is a tribute to both Yeshayahu's and Nechama's stature that they were both well-known in their own right and not as the brother of or the sister of. For different, obviously in our shir, Yeshayahu is the brother of Nechama, but in general, they really had their own reputations in their own right. For different segments of society, though, one of them is more likely to be better known than the other. For much of the diaspora, and especially for American Jews, the primary association with the name Leibowitz is Nechama, whereas for many Israelis, it is Yeshayahu. But for many, both names ring a bell. Both represent a watershed and their respective fields. Jewish philosophy has been known to be divided into before and after Yeshayahu Leibowitz, and Tanakh study into before and after Nechama Leibowitz. The two had great mutual respect and affection. This is, I think, probably one of the most touching facts about Nechama's life, and that above all, she was just a sweet, warm, kind, loving person. And you really see that highlighted when you see, we'll read in just a second, about the relationship that she had with her brother. And really, the relationship that Yeshayahu had with her, right? It was really mutual love for one another. Yeshayahu praised Nechama with a verse from Proverbs. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. He considered Nechama a leading expert in Tanakh, turning to her with questions in her field and remarking, she brought people to open the Tanakh, and my sister is the only person in Israel who knows what Tanakh is. Yeshayahu, in turn, was a very significant figure in Nechama's life, and she praised him to others as a wonderful man. Note, obviously, it's hard to make a complete implication out of this, but she did not necessarily comment on his Torah knowledge. She commented on just the fact that he was just a good man. She loved him as her brother. Nechama was the younger by 2 years, and growing up as Yeshayahu, Leibowitz's little sister, may not have been a simple matter. She mentioned to Dr. Shmuel Adler that at home, her brother was considered a genius while she was considered average. Nechama also claimed that Shaya always beat her in their father's Tanakh quizzes, though this may have been her modesty talking, since other claims claim that she actually won. While she never gave the appearance of being intimidated by him in later life, she may have consciously or unconsciously experienced herself as inferior to Yeshayahu, who had a breadth of expertise that she did not. On the other hand, the companionship of such a brilliant brother probably also accelerated her development and influence in its direction. Even after they left home, the two continued to correspond. Among Yeshayahu's published letters, the earliest dated are to Nechama, sent at age 25 from Cologne, where he was studying medicine. In one of these, he explains to her the basics of epistemology and recommends articles for her to read. Yeshayahu settled in Israel not long after Nechama, right? We'll see in a few moments when Nechama did make Aliyah, but she was, of course, in Europe in the early years of her life. So yeah, Yeshayahu was settled in Israel not long after Nechama, and their connection resting on affection and on a shared capacity for intellectual exchange continued throughout their lives. They periodically spent time together sitting on a Shabbat afternoon, arguing volubly on Nechama's balcony or traveling back together from Tel Aviv University, where Yeshayahu also lectured from time to time. Her brother's family was the closest thing to Nechama's own, and after her father's death, she spent every Passover Seder with them. All right, we'll stop right there. Feel free to read the rest of the paragraph on your own. She had a very close relationship with her brother, and it really was something very special. Take a look at source number 2, though. So Yeshayahu Leibowitz, as we said a second ago, he had a very complicated theological and hashkafic perspective of the world, and in particular, I'm a little concerned about time, so we won't read it inside, but you can feel free to read source number two on your own, because at the end of the day, this is a shir on Nechama Leibowitz, not Yeshayahu Leibowitz. But his perspective on God is what was most troubling. And not that he said that God was less powerful, necessarily, but that he said that he was such a powerful being, he was so amazing, that the thought that he would interact with man was very troubling as a concept to Yeshayahu. And therefore, he sort of believed that man was here and God was up here, but never the two shall meet. And obviously, that's very complicated and complex to say for an Orthodox Jew who believes in everything in Hashgacha Pratis, that God is actively involved in our lives all the time. So how can you say such a thing? So that's why he was sort of outside of the camp of what we would call mainstream Orthodoxy. But again, he believed what he believed, not because he thought less of God, but because he thought God was this amazing being. Nonetheless, that was something very hashkafically complicated for us to sort of internalize. I did once take a class in YU about Yeshayahu Leibowitz and other 20th century philosophers. He is fascinating as an academic approach. If you want to study him, I would recommend it. But again, for the most part, I would say that we don't accept many of his philosophical teachings as they apply to Judaism because of their complexity with, in particular, the Yud-Gimel Yikamer of the Rambam and the like. They really don't seem to fully mesh entirely. Okay, so Nechama had a very beautiful childhood. She loved growing up with her brother and her father. Her mother did pass away at an early age. What's interesting to note also about Nechama's childhood is that you would think someone who was such a big educator, she would have loved her school education. She hated school. She didn't actually go to a formal school until 10th grade. They moved to Berlin in 1919. That was when she was 14 years old, for those of you who are keeping track at home. When she was 14 years old, they moved to Berlin. That's when she finally went to school for the first time. It was her 10th grade. She is quoted as saying that she had a terrible education, that she just thought it was the most horrific thing ever. So again, just fascinating to sort of see how she becomes an excellent teacher, and you would probably imply that the reason why she was such a great teacher is because she saw how terrible a teacher could be, so she wanted to be the exact opposite of that. While she was living in Berlin, we all know or are quite familiar with it, in particular when we learned about the Rav, that Berlin was a very hopping place in the early 1900s. There were lots of big gedolim that we are aware of. We know the Rav, we know the Lubavitcher Rebbe, we know Rav Huttner was sort of all kind of swimming around there. The big fans of Nechama Leibowitz like to try to figure out how much she associated with them, and they'll do as much as they can to try to find a time where any of these big gedolim spoke about Nechama, but at the end of the day, they don't really seem to... All gedolim don't really seem to always speak about each other that much in general. But the argument would be that since she was in Berlin in these early 1900s, she probably interacted with some of these Ravim, if not on an official, regular level. You know, the odds of her walking down the street and seeing them was pretty high as well. So that was sort of the caliber of masterful Torah education that was around. But again, they were all men, and she was the woman. She was the Yosei Min HaKlal. She finished high school in 1925, she was at the age 20 years old, and so for us that sounds a little bit crazy, but I'm told that that's a normal age for back in the day for her to have finished high school. She spent time after that in three universities, in the University of Berlin, of Heidelberg, and Marburg. She studied English and German philology and literature and biblical studies. She was very smart, and she studied lots of things. She also studied at Berlin College, and what's notable about her experience when she was in Berlin College is that she learned, she did take classes on various sources in Judaism, and this was the first time and the only time in her life where she received a formal Jewish education. Everything else that she received in terms of Torah knowledge was either at home or by herself, but she never really received a formal Jewish education other than when she was at Berlin College. In 1930, this was a very important year in Nechama's life, so 1930 means she was 25 years old. So Nechama completed her PhD in the University of Marburg. Her dissertation was on translation techniques of Judeo-German Bible translations in the 15th and 16th centuries, as exemplified by translations on the Book of Psalms in English. It means that what she did was she studied various Yiddish translations of Tanakh and how they impacted our understanding of the text itself. While she was going for her PhD, she was also doing a lot of teaching on the side. She was a very big fan of the Ivrit B'Ivrit method, right? Some schools do use it nowadays, this idea of teaching Jewish studies in Hebrew. And, you know, I'm a big fan of it as well. In theory, I think that at the end of the day, one of the biggest things that we should lament about as an American Jewish community is that most students who spend 12 years in Jewish day school can't speak a word of Hebrew. I went to Jewish day school my whole life, and this is not to put down my school, but I did not come out speaking much Hebrew. When I went to yeshiva in Israel, that's when I learned how to speak Hebrew. So Ivrit b'Ivrit is probably a really important thing to follow, and that was Nechama Leibowitz's something that she was very into. She taught Bible without really translating it, rather just sort of giving a Hebrew explanation. And as 1930 went on, once she completed her PhD, like we said, it's a very important year. It's also the year that she got married, and also the year that she made Aliyah. She made Aliyah the day after she got married. Now, Nechama's marriage is probably one of the most controversial things in her life, in particular because her husband was not only 30 years older than her, but she was also married to her uncle. So there are some very, very complicated recordings of this and why she did this. At the end of the day, at least those who seem to like Nechama and respect her and the Sora that she left over seem to say that she was married to her uncle because she loved him, and that's certainly how she spoke about him. Take a look at source number 5. On page 7, the number isn't there though. So, marriage and Aliyah. So, several misconceptions surround Nechama's marriage, perhaps because she was so independent, or perhaps because her last name never changed. Some are of the belief that she never married at all. Others suppose that she married but kept her maiden name. Both are mistaken, as Joy Roshwarger, a close student of Nechama's in her later years, discovered to her surprise when asking Nechama's opinion on love. She began, "Nechama, how do you know when you love someone?" And Nechama, in her very Nechama-esque way, as you'll also come away with this, hopefully being able to say what a Nechama-esque way of answering is, but she says, "What do you mean? How do you know?" "You know," replied Nechama. "Well, what did your parents think of your husband?" She said, "What do you mean? They loved him." She said back, "How do you know?" "Well, he used to come to my house every day for lunch." She said, Why did he come to your house every day for lunch?" She said, "Well, he was my uncle." So indeed, Nechama had married her father's brother, Yedidya Lipman Leibowitz. Her marital situation was puzzling to many. They wondered why she would marry a much older ailing uncle. Not daring to discuss it with her directly, some speculated that perhaps she had altruistic motives, for thus she could take care of Lipman without transgressing any Jewish laws, right? The notion of Negia and Yichud and all the things, all the halakhic issues that could take place. So some people said maybe she married him to take care of him properly so that she could be in Yichud and so that she could touch him to help him properly. But the truth is that Nechama married for love. Professor Chana Safrai, a friend and colleague of Nechama's on several occasions, visited Lipman's gravesite with Nechama and heard facts from her own lips. Apparently, the marriage was not without its obstacles. Decades older than she, he already suffered from a condition causing deteriorating eyesight, and her choice was resisted by some of those close to her. Nevertheless, she followed her heart and pushed ahead with it, waiting only due to Lipman's assistance to finish her PhD first. With this accomplished, the couple were married in 1930 in Berlin, and Nechama declared to Safrai, "This was the wisest decision I ever made, and I have been extremely happy my entire life." Nechama viewed the job of looking after her husband as a lover's privilege rather than a duty. Simi Peters recalls long conversations with Nechama while collating worksheets together. She talked about him not as one would speak about a revered uncle, but in the way any woman talks about her husband, with that mixture of affection and a certain knowingness. Nechama encouraged others to follow their hearts too, even in the face of adversity. Her attitude towards love was similar to her attitude towards Torah. It should be completely intuitive with no room for doubt, and things like age difference should not matter. The only thing she regretted was never having children. Of course, one of the famous things about Nechama is that she didn't have any kids. No point in making any speculations, but at the end of the day, you would assume the fact that he was 30 years older than her might have had something to do with it. But again, I'm not a big fan of speculating, because who knows exactly why or how that happened, but that was one of the biggest things that she did regret in her life. She's not a woman who had many regrets, but that was the one thing that she often spoke about, that she wished she would have had children to care for. Now, one thing we did leave out was we mentioned that Nechama's mother did pass away at a young age. And her father, of course, was a really important part of her life. You would imagine that in a world that this was an Orthodox family, and in a world that's so dominated by men, especially at that point, the notion of having a woman who would become such a great educator and such a knowledgeable woman in Tanakh, she had to have had a really great Torah upbringing. Since she didn't have any formal schooling, you'd imagine the only person, especially since her mother passed away at a young age, must have been her father teaching and encouraging her. So take a look at source number 4. Go back for one second where Nechama speaks about her father. It's just a dedication. So we'll see that among the many publications that Nechama had in her life, she also published what we call Iyunim, studies in the various books of the Torah, and she says it's just a dedication. This book is dedicated to the memory, source number four, where we were just a second ago, the same page. This book is dedicated to the memory of my father of blessed memory, who was my first childhood teacher of Rashi, and he, ever zealous for the Hebrew language, taught me above all to hear and to taste the fine flavor of Rashi's language and style. You can see and so clearly how she spoke so lovingly of her father and how important of a figure he was in terms of her own Torah knowledge and education. Okay, going back to the life that she had, so she, in 1930, was said she got her PhD, and then she was married to her husband, Yedidya Lipman. The day after they got married, like we said, she made Aliyah. Now, this was something that was always a passion of hers, this was something that she had always sort of seen herself doing. It was something that was clearly stressed in their home, and as a result, making Aliyah was without question. It just seems like it was something that was always the plan, and her uncle seemed to follow in suit. Take a look at source number six. It doesn't speak about how or why she decided to make Aliyah, but just sort of a cute story of when she first got to Israel. Nechama told a lovely story about their arrival in Jerusalem. It was designed to show her her own naivete and misconceptions. When my husband and I arrived in Israel, we were ecstatic. Everything impressed us. As we rode through the hills of Judea and observed the beautiful scenery, we were overwhelmed with emotion. And then as we came nearer to Jerusalem, I saw a sign, Lahamshich b'hiluch namuch. My husband could no, which means continue in low gear. My husband could no longer see well, so in great excitement, I read it out to him. Isn't it wonderful, I said, that they even have signs on the road telling people to approach the holy city with the proper modesty. And that's obviously not what the sign was saying, but this was also sort of Nechama's approach to life. She always saw the most beautiful perspective in everything. This was obviously a road sign telling you to clearly shift gears on your car, but the fact that she was able to see... Sorry? Exactly. The fact that she was able to see something like this, something so mundane, with such a spiritual note, was really just, there's no other story, I don't think, that could fully encompass the personality and the perspective that she had in life, other than this story. Now, when she was in Israel, so she was a young woman, her and her husband settled down very quickly, she became a teacher, she taught in many Mizrahi schools with many of the religious Zionist youth. She began teaching in the Mizrahi Teacher Seminary of Jerusalem. She taught there for 22 years. Originally she would teach Tanakh and various other topics like literature and Hebrew expression and Jewish history, but ultimately she at some point shifted only to Tanakh, and that obviously became the major study of her life. 1942 was the year that everything changed for us. And why I say that is because 1942 was when Nechama started doing her famous Gilyo Note. Right? For those of you who aren't aware, her Gilyo Note were pieces of paper that had questions on them and quotes on them from various Perushim and from various parts of the Gemara that encouraged people to learn the Parsha that we were learning that week. So let's see a little bit more about this inside of one of the sources. So again, 1942, age 37. That's when she started these Gilyo Note. The way they started was that she was teaching a class. Well, you know what? Let's see the source. Source number seven. How the Gilyo Note came into being. It's right beneath source number six. The story of this groundbreaking endeavor begins with the Mizrahi graduate program for young immigrant women mentioned in the previous chapter. Every week, Nechama assigned her students questions on the Torah portion and the challenge of grappling with the commentators' approaches, Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, etc., became the highlight of their week. Every Shabbat afternoon, small groups of students might be seen sitting on the grass discussing the current worksheet. After Shabbat, they pooled their answers and handed in the group effort to Nechama. She felt free to rate their answers with words and phrases such as good, not enough, and so on, rather than with formal grades. She encouraged them to fill out as many Gilyo Notes as possible, believing that it was an excellent way to advance. In fact, it became known among the students that a surefire technique to restore Nechama's good humor was to mention having filled one out. That summer of 1942, after the young women returned to their kibbutzim, a rare, if not unique, event in the history of education occurred. Though the school year was over, the students asked for more homework. These young women, who had maintained a strong personal connection with Nechama, wrote to her asking to continue the questionnaires under her supervision. More than happy to oblige, right? Again, because at the end of the day, Nechama did not do this because she wanted to become a wealthy woman. She believed in teaching and education. That was who and what she was all about. So more than happy to oblige to continue doing a lot more work on her part, she mailed the first sheet to the women in at their respective kibbutzim. The next thing that occurred, which was quite as surprising, was that the young women's kibbutz friends began to envy them, their their avid scribbling and wrote to Nechama asking for worksheets too. These are women who didn't have a relationship with her, but they saw this is amazing. For whatever reason, these worksheets were able to engage her students in such a great way that even in the summer they wanted to be involved, so their friends also wanted to do it. She unhesitatingly agreed to the stranger's request, despite the extra load it entailed, and that was how it all began. It's important to understand, it's not that she just sent these worksheets out and said, okay, here, enjoy. Then if people wanted to, they could mail them back to her and she would grade each and every one. Now, the above account is based on accounts by Professor Dov Rappel and others. Nechama's version of the story of the birth of the Gilyonot shows a little more premeditation. I noticed that all sorts of subjects are taught by correspondence, from architecture to accountancy, from advertising to stenography, and I said, shall not our perfect Torah at the very least resemble one of these? Elsewhere, she explained, the problems of adult education began to occupy and trouble me from my work in short courses for kibbutz members and for immigrant youth and movement counselors. I realized that there was a need for these studies to continue. An idea came to me to carry on this brief seminar study via a guided correspondence course, leading to regular study over a prolonged period. And thus it was that in 5702, 1942, I began to teach Torah and commentaries by means of worksheets for studying the weekly portion, whose chief aim was to bring the students, individuals, or groups to independent study, to a deeper examination of the text through comparison and analysis and a thorough exploration of the commentaries. No exam or certificate or even a set period was attached to this study. In any event, regardless of the exact causes and beginnings, an endeavor unique in Jewish history had been born. It was really one of the most fascinating things that you can actually imagine. I don't know, has anyone in this room ever filled out a Gilyon? One of the Gilyonot? Okay, so we'll God willing, towards the end of this class, in true Nechama Leibowitz style, we'll hopefully do a Gilyon together from Parshas Bahar that we just had this past Shabbos. But it really became a new cultural experience in the world. She really created a fad that that many other that came before and after her have not been able to do. And that is that she began, like we said, to send out these worksheets, and it just grew and grew and grew. She first sent to some of her students, and then she sent to a larger group who became quote unquote jealous. And ultimately, I believe the numbers were that sometime around the 1980s, she had sent out and received back over 40,000 of these individual sheets. That's a wild number to sort of wrap your head around, but that's what Nechama was all about. She did not get paid for this. She didn't make a dime off of this. It was all about Torah Lishma, just making sure that people can engage and learn the text properly. She believed, and she was a very, very modest and humble person, but when her she was able to understand that she had some knowledge and understanding of the text, and she understood that she was able to help other people realize that. So what her sheets were, there was no information written on it to the extent of explanation. It was only questions. So you have the look at these psukim, and here is a source that I found interesting. Tell me, what does this mean? There was no actual knowledge. She wasn't actually giving over anything. It was simply, she was the preparer, and everyone else engaged in it. Then they would send it back, and obviously Nechama, knowing all the perspectives and answers, it seems, was able to comment on if it was good or not good. You can imagine that being a teacher and grading papers is probably not the highest, the most exciting thing in a teacher's life, but she is someone who graded literally thousands and thousands of students' papers and people who she never met before, but she graded their papers as well if they were sent to her. Now, Nechama kept this up. You know what, take a look at source number 8 first. Word got around, just continuing and sort of understanding the grasp of this movement. The next year, 50 people requested Gilyonot. By the third year, there were 300 correspondents putting out the Gilyonot. In those early years, was a joint project in which both her father and her husband took part. Yael Stiefel recalls how the elder Leibowitz even folded and addressed Gilyonot from his hospital bed in Shari Tzedek. It was also his job when he was well to take the mail to the closest post office, which in those days was all the way to Machane Yehuda, at least 30 minutes from their neighborhood. Every Tuesday, the whole house was full of Gilyonot, recalls Rabbi Aryeh Noel, who as a child used to visit his aunt, Nechama's neighbor. They were on all the tables, on the chairs, even on the beds. You can imagine Nechama not being a wealthy woman. She would sort of get these packages on a weekly basis, thousands of Gilyonot from all over the place, and where are they going to be? It's not like she had a big mansion. So they'd be all over the place, and she would get to them, and she would get to them, and she would mark them when she got a chance to. It really did. I can't stress enough. It really just became a subculture in Israel, but really all over the world. She had international students, if you will, sending in these sheets. Now, in 1954, it's another important year in Nechama's life. Those of you keeping track at home, that means she was 49 years old. Nechama was adamantly against giving answers to people, giving answers to students. Not because she didn't have them, but because she, like we said, she wanted people to be able to think for themselves. However, after being swayed and convinced enough, she was told by some of her mentors and some people that it might be worthwhile for her to actually write her own commentary to sort of help those who can't even engage with the questions, which again was hard for Nechama to believe that there were people who couldn't really engage with it, but she began to understand there were people who had very busy lives, literally didn't have a second. If they wanted to learn a little bit of Torah, the Gil Yonot wouldn't quite cut it. So in 1954, that's when the new series that she put out, known as Iyunim Be, right, studies in, right, Debbie, that's the whole set that you own. So essentially what it is just many, many books and many, many essays on each parsha, going through with her method of saying, this is what Rashi says, this is what the Ramban says, etc., etc. It's obviously different for every single parsha, and this is what I think, and this is how it sort of all fuses together. And this, again, was something not something that she did with ease, but she did it because she thought there was a need and an importance for people to sort of be able to have something spoon-fed to them, just so that they would be able to get some Torah knowledge at the very least. Now, over the years, beyond that, Nechama also published 5 other books. I have lists if anyone is interested in any other books, but she did publish on other topics as well and in other areas. In 1957, she began lecturing in Tel Aviv University. By 1969, she becomes a full-fledged professor there. Now, in 1970, Nechama's husband passed away, and this was a very difficult year for her. She spoke often about how she and her husband were essentially chavrutas, that she and her husband used to learn together, they would study together. He was a very important part of her life in every aspect, but in particular in terms of preparing these gilyonot. Not only was he, in a sense, an assistant for her, but she was able to fully get out all the gilyonot with his help. And that's why in 1971, 30 full cycles after her project began of the Gilyonot, when she would send out new worksheets every single week, that's when she stopped publishing new Gilyonot. And it seems like the reason why is because her husband passed away and she both physically couldn't do it anymore and just emotionally she wasn't able to continue doing this without her chavruta, who was no longer there. Now, Nechama's life, as we said, really was all about teaching and conveying over this love and beauty and complexity of what Tanakh and what Torah represented. So like I said, in just a few moments, we're going to actually go through one of her Gilyonot together to really immerse ourselves in the experience of who and what Nechama Leibowitz was. But before we do that, I wanted to just speak a little bit more about Nechama's personality as a whole and who she really was. So take a look at source number 9. Source number 9, page 12. Nechama is said, among other positive qualities, that she just had the most amazing personality. And by that, what people meant was that she had a personality that was sort of able to mold itself to whatever situation she found herself in, and that she would find herself on both extremes of a spectrum. So take a look at source number 9. Many will remember Nechama not so much for her scholarship, but for her special combination of traits. Her vigorous, warm personality, which expressed itself, as one student puts it, in her fantastic mobile eyebrows and warm and lovely eyes. Superlatives and are commonplace in descriptions. Nechama's personality was such that she was able to contain opposing, even paradoxical traits and values within herself. This important key to both her personality and her intellectual outlook will be emphasized throughout this book. While some adjectives such as lazy or greedy are not applicable to Nechama at all, in many cases she possessed both a trait and its opposite. She was sophisticated yet naive, serious yet humorous, pious yet liberal, rationalistic yet emotional, sensitive and subtle. She was also forceful and brusque, firmly down to earth and logical. She might suddenly be swept away by the lyricism of a verse. Nechama was methodical and punctual, yet lived a hectic lifestyle, running out at the last minute to lecture and forgetting her pages. Her words regarding the patriarch Abraham's greatness in containing extremes could have been written with little alteration of herself. In other words, this is speaking about Abraham. In other words, Abraham mustered all his inner resource, both his gentle and hard qualities, love and fear, mildness and boldness, ready to do combat on behalf of Sodom. That does sound a lot like Nechama, that she shared both of those qualities, that she shared both sides of the spectrum. Nechama was thus a complex person, and even her complexity was balanced by an equal portion of simplicity. This diversity was an expression of the quality of truth in Nechama, an appreciation of the multiplicity of this world. She liked well-roundedness and others, approving in a student such activities as tennis alongside more cerebral pursuits. Now, like we said, I apologize. Okay, in 1972, At age 67, so that's the year after her husband passed away, she officially retired from her position at Tel Aviv University. She continued teaching for many more years into her old into a very old life. In source number 10, you'll see just a very cute story about Nechama and her old age. Nechama remained extremely young at heart in her late 80s, vacationing at the Reich Hotel for Passover. She complained that she was not enjoying herself. "What's the matter?" asked a friend. "Is it the food?" "The food is fine." "What then, your room?" "No, the room is fine." "So then what's wrong?" "Well, everyone here is so old." When Nechama was in her 80s, she really did remain a very youthful personality all the way until the very end, and she followed suit in terms of her teaching. She always kept that same energy, excitement, and exuberance that she brought to her teaching up until the very end, until she was no longer able to teach. I would say now, let's turn to page 13. So page 13 is, as we've been mentioning for the past while, one of the Gilyo notes by Nechama. So what I really want to do is, again, this is slightly different than the model that we've been following, but I really believe that there's no way to properly give a biographical shiur about her life without learning some of her Torah, without learning some of her Gilyonot, because that's really what she was all about, and it was one of the most important things in her life, to be able to have students. If we could talk to Nechama right now, you could imagine she would be so upset that we were hearing a biography of her life without learning some Torah. So that's what we're going to do right now, to properly learn some of the Torah that she helped share. So everyone take a look at page 13. So now, we're really just going to shift to a regular type of shiur for a few moments. In yesterday's parsha, the psukim teach us. We'll read them in English, although the Hebrew is really important. So feel free to follow along in the Hebrew as well. We're talking about the prohibition of ribis, right? Of giving interest. So the psukim say, if your kinsman being in straits comes under your authority, and you hold him as though a resident alien, let him live by your side. Do not exact from him advance or accrued interest, but fear your God. Let him live by your side as your kinsman. Do not lend him your money at advanced interest, or give him your food at accrued interest. I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. So those are the psukim that we're going to be discussing for the next few moments. This is the prohibition of charging interest to a Jewish person. So Nechama begins her Gilyon by quoting the Gemara in Bava Metzia on Ayin Hei Amud Beis. The Gemara reads as follows: "And these people violate the prohibition of interest, the lender and the borrower and the guarantor and the witnesses. And the rabbis say, also the scribe who writes the promissory notes violates this prohibition. These parties to the transaction violate different prohibitions. Some are in violation of, you shall not give him your money with interest, and of, do not take from him interest or increase, and of, do not be to him as a creditor, and of, do not place interest upon him, and you shall not place a stumbling block before the blind, and you shall fear your God. I am the Lord." Now, this is not exactly the most exciting topic, but you'll see that Nechama finds a way to even make this an exciting and invigorating topic. So look at the first question that we see over here, number one. So you'll notice there are two stars above the number one. Nechama, when she would send out these worksheets, obviously when she was just with her own students, she would be able to tell them, just so you know, question three or question four are very difficult. Obviously, as she would send these questions out to many people, she wouldn't have a personal conversation with everyone, so she began marking little stars next to the question to tell you how hard it is. No stars means that it's not so bad. One star means that it's kind of hard. Two stars and more would mean that it's very, very difficult. So this is a two-star. I don't know.
Four
stars? I don't know exactly, but two. but two stars is very difficult. So let's take a look at the question. We'll read it in Hebrew, and we can imagine as we read it, as Nechama reading it herself. Hatuchal lehasbir lama hakdima hagemara es pasuk lamed zayin ve'acharav et lamed vav ve'lama lo halacha lefi seder hapsukim b'torah. Why are you able to explain why it is that if you looked at the Gemara that we just read, the pesukim are out of order? We just said there's a prohibition of charging interest, but the Gemara first quotes Pasuk Lamed Zayin, and then after quotes Pasuk Lamed Chet. Why is it that the Gemara puts them in a different order, and why not according to the regular order that the Torah gives it? Now, I'll tell you, I went through this entire Gilyon, and you can ask Rina, it took me well over an hour to do this entire thing. So we'll together try to come to some of the answers, and we probably won't be able to do the whole thing. But what do you guys think? What's the answer to that question? Why would the Gemara flip the order of the Pesukim? Again, imagine yourself receiving this in the mail from Nechama Leibowitz herself. She sent it to you, and she's expecting an answer. So what's the answer?
That's probably how many stars. just got two stars, and I'm like stumped.
This is a hard question. It's a hard question. So let's look at the psukim again, right? That's how we should do it. So Perek Lamed Zayin would be, so we start with, the first is Lamed, if you go back to the English, Lamed Hey, and then we have Lamed, so fine. Lamed Zayin is, Al Tikach Mito Neshech V'Tarbes, don't take interest, V'Yarasam Elokecha V'Chayachicha Yimach, right? You should fear God. And then it says, Es Kasbecha Lo Titein Lo, right? His money, you shouldn't give him B'Neshech with interest, U'Vamarbes, Lo Titein Achlecha. So why would that verse come before the verse before it?
Don't they sound the same?
They do sound very similar. What's the difference?
One's giving, one's taking.
Go on. Which one's giving and which one's taking?
The first one's taking, the second one's giving.
Okay, good. Why is that significant? By the way, I'm gonna tell you, I have answers that I wrote down that I think are the answers. I have no idea if they're correct. So I'll tell you what I think the answer to this one is, since it's a little harder, but the other ones you have to tell me the answers. I think that if you look at the psukim, so just like Debbie said, the second one is giving and the first one's taking. Maybe the second pasuk, even though it's out of order from the Torah's perspective, we'll have to understand why the Torah put it in that perspective, maybe for another time. But from the Gemara's perspective, the second pasuk is the motivating one. And what does that mean? It's the one where the lender says, don't begin to think that you'll give this to the guy and you'll be able to take interest. So if you want to order the pasukim properly, if you want to say what the prohibition is, first you list the motivation and then you list the actual prohibition. Maybe pasuk lamed zayin is the motivation that says, you think you're going to lend this guy, you'll make some money off the guy. That's the motivation. And the second pasuk lists the prohibition in full, and therefore don't you dare take anything from him. So perhaps that's why the Gemara put them in that order. The first pasuk is all about the motivation. The second is the full prohibition of not taking the interest. Like it, don't like it? Yeah, some of you like it. Okay, let's take a look at question number two. It gets a little easier, don't worry. What is the connection of the verse in Leviticus 19:14? And you shall not place a stumbling block before the blind, so the prohibition of interest, so the creditor and the borrower not know what will happen. Right, so you'll notice in the Gemara, that's the last pasuk that's quoted. You'll notice, by the way, that there are five psukim quoted. We'll get to that in a few moments. Anyone? Well, actually, let's get to it now. Why is it that there are five psukim quoted in this Gemara? Isn't it just one prohibition? Give me one pasuk. How many people are referred to in the Gemara? Five different people, right? We have the Malveh, the Loveh, the Arev, the Edim, and the Sofer. So I would say that there are five people in the Gemara, and therefore there are five psukim that are meant to go with each person. Okay, now with that, why is there this pasuk of not putting a stumbling block before a blind person? How is that relevant to this prohibition?
Well, even though it says, do they not know what's going to happen? Sure, they know what's going to happen, but by doing this, it's enabling this bad stuff to happen.
Who's doing the enabling? Who's the real enabler of all these people?
Well, the person that's writing, is it an enabler?
The person who's writing the document, right?
Right.
So that's what I would say as well. I would agree that ultimately you have the person who's lending, the person who's borrowing, you have the guarantor, you have the witnesses, but who's the person who's perpetuating everything here? The person who's writing down the document of sale. That's the guy who's the real real violator of Lo Titein Michshol, of putting a stumbling block before the person. So therefore, I would argue the answer to this question might be that this prohibition of not placing a stumbling block is related to just this person, speaking to the sofer, speaking to the one who wrote down the document itself.
Okay? Is the sofer being instructed what they're
He so is, but ultimately he's true. But ultimately he's the one. He could have said, "No, I don't want to write it."
You're being paid a fee. If you're being paid a fee, you do it.
Okay.
He's profiting from the interest. That's what makes him really a violator as well. If there was no interest, there wouldn't be what? He wouldn't. Yeah. If there was no interest, there wouldn't be enough profit in it for him to be paid.
Okay. Yeah, Sam.
The sofer is like an accessory.
It's exactly right. He is the accessory, and therefore he's the one. I would say even a little bit more than an accessory. He is the one sort of
the enabler.
Right. The enabler. Exactly. Okay. Good. Everyone like that? Feel free to disagree. Nachama would like it if you disagree. Okay. Okay. Moving forward. So we have the next section over here, section Bet, And that is that the Torah says, v'hechzakta bo. So the full pasuk is, and if thy brother be waxen poor and his means fail with thee, then thou shalt uphold him. So Rashi over here says, do not leave him by himself so that he descends and falls when it will be difficult to give him a lift, but uphold him from the very moment of the failure of his means. To what may this, the difference between whether you assist him at once or whether you wait with your help till he has come down in the world, be compared to an excessive load on the back of a donkey? So long as it is still on the donkey's back, one person is enough to take hold of it, the load, and to keep it, the donkey, up as soon as it has fallen to the ground. Not even five people are able to set it on its legs. So, that was Rashi. First question, a famous question of Nachama Leibowitz, ma kasha la Rashi b'psukeinu? What is difficult to Rashi in our verse? In other words, if you look at the explanation that Rashi gives, what word was so complex to him that he said, you know, there needs to be a full explanation here? Okay, good. What was so difficult to Rashi that he decided to write his explanation, right? Every single time a commentator uses ink, right, nowadays we just pick up a pen and we just write things. But back in the day when the commentators would write something, they would write it and they would be using up valuable ink and valuable materials. So Rashi had a very specific purpose, thing that he was really trying to accomplish when he wrote this pirush. So what was he trying to explain in the pasuk?
Obviously, it's to help your neighbor or your brother who is in difficulty. So,
when to do it. When to do it.
Okay, good. When to do it.
Whether you should wait or do it, to look at it, what was the right time to be able to help
them. Okay, good. We're getting closer. Good. When is that time? Good.
If you should be proactive.
Oh, okay, good. Right, it's all about being proactive. Are you going to let the guy fail and then help him up, or are you going to a few minutes before that, are you going to help him out? So the word is v'hechzakta, right? Debbie said it, v'hechzakta bo, the idea of strengthening him. You're going to come in and strengthen him. You're not going to come in and after he's totally destitute, you're going to lift him up. Rather, you're going to see him in his really downtrodden state, but not totally have fallen off. And you're going to v'hechzakta bo, to lift him up, to strengthen him a little bit before he totally falls off.
But the explanatory is that from the very moment of failure that you perceive him failing, that's what he's supposed to do. From the very moment you see,
right, it's the moment that you see him about to go down, but before he actually goes down.
Right,
right, exactly. Struggling, but not totally falling.
Right.
Okay, I think. Do you want to do one more question, or do you want to?
Yeah.
it's like you're doing me a favor. Sure. Okay, one more question. One more question. I'll try to find a good one. Okay. Take a look at question number 3. L'shem mahivi Rashi kan es mashal hachamor maratza l'avir al yidei kach. If you look at this, the psukim, donkeys aren't mentioned. Why does Rashi bring up the parable of a donkey in the first place?
Very visual. You can immediately see, understand what is being described.
Okay, good. Maybe it's one, it's just a visual aid, right? But why couldn't he have just said, let's say you see a person holding a heavy package?
There's so much discussion in the Gemara about a donkey being overloaded.
Okay, good.
When you should help him, or should you help your enemy first, or should you help the other fellow second?
Now, what's really problematic is that there are specific psukim that actually have a prohibition if you see someone's donkey falling. Yeah. But this seems to not be necessarily right about that. It seems to just be about a regular guy who's carrying a package or something like that.
You really can visualize how all you have to do is one person come take a little load off the donkey and he'll be able to stay upright. You can visualize it taking five people to lift a donkey back up when he's down. Right? So it just, I don't know, when I read it, it just made so much sense to me with that type of visualization.
Okay.
So a donkey may not realize that he's beginning to fail, and you have to be the one to be appreciative of that person is failing. Whereas if you're talking about a human being, they know that they're failing and they can ask for help. So even with a donkey, you may not know to ask for help.
Okay,
you have to be appreciative of the fact.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that what Rashi's trying to stress is that it's not just about helping. Let's say you see a guy who's like really struggling, but let's say he has an extension of him struggling, like an animal or something like that. Will you go to that extent to help him? And Rashi's point is that you'll go, that you have to go to even the farthest extent to help someone and make sure they're not struggling. Is that, is that what you're saying? No? Say it again.
No, no. If he uses a person as an example, the person carrying the load says, oh, it's getting too heavy for me, help me, and you go help him. Whereas with the donkey has no way of communicating to you. You have to be aware. It's up to you.
It requires more of a self-awareness, in other words.
How about the phrase that the ounce of prevention is worth more than something right. So here you have the ounce is the prevention, which is the one person has the authority, but the pound of the cure is how much of the cure you need to get the donkey to actually stretch that up again. So, I mean, it's very similar to that.
Okay.
Idiom, proverb.
Okay. Okay, Jerry.
No, I was just thinking about in the Torah, so many places that a donkey is used for us to try to understand, like to make almost a donkey human. But we talk in Parshas Balak where a donkey actually is speaking, and so maybe this, you know, maybe comparing to the human being who's failing like that and who needs help. That's not what I really want to say. That the donkey actually is an example of the closest that the Torah even talks about in terms of an animal being like a human being, but it's really more of a metaphor than it is reality. I would think Rashi is trying to give us, you know, let us think more. You know, maybe we don't think more about the seriousness of even an animal that's, you know, we should know. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but there's some connection that Rashi must be thinking. Not that I should think of what Rashi's thinking.
No, you should. Someone's trying to figure it out. Okay, but good. You're really, I like where you're going. Yeah, Mark?
I think it's actually just the opposite of what he said. I think it's a donkey doesn't know he's in trouble, and so you got to help the man, help the donkey before the load falls. The man may not know he's in trouble. You got to step in and help him before he even asks for that.
That's right.
Or if you don't be willing to ask.
Yes, Simma?
Well, you have to be aware of your surroundings, not be focused on yourself, and sort of be aware of what's happening around you, and offer help when someone needs the help. They may not know that they need the help. But in other words, don't be so egocentric. Be more, aware of your surroundings.
Okay, very nice.
So,
David?
One of the things the donkey theoretically uses is a beast of burden. Maybe it's just telling us that we should be proactive and do anything we can to lighten somebody's burden, even a donkey.
Oh, very nice. Okay, good. Madeline?
So it seems to me the one thing we didn't talk about is that it would take even that to lift the donkey once it's fallen, right? It would take even not even five persons are able to set it on its legs. So if you wait until a person has completely failed, then this doesn't sound so nice, but like it takes a lot more community resources and other things to get that person back, as opposed to just taking, being proactive and not letting that happen.
Okay, good.
More of a burden on the community.
Okay, really good. Okay.
So also, doesn't it talk about the Torah, about the donkey that walks into the brick wall?
With Bilam, you're saying?
Not with Bilam. Isn't there another place in our literature?
It's by Bilam.
Is it by Bilam where he walks into the brick wall?
Yeah.
So are we going to let a person walk into a brick wall?
Okay.
You know, before we, standing there watching, someone who could help.
Okay, could
let
be.
Him do that.
Could be, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, it would just be, you know, if you wait too long, it would just be almost impossible, maybe, for the person to really, be helped. It would be so, so difficult.
Right.
And why wait to that point?
Right, yeah.
Well, it may also be the magnitude of, in this case, the burden that can be carried. As long as it's properly set, the help of one person can keep it from tumbling, even if it's an excessive load. But
if it's off-center, if it's not appropriate, then even five people can't help it. So when it talks about treating a situation properly, making sure everything is, whether it's the baggage of the animal or the baggage of life, is loaded properly, a little bit of help is useful and can keep it going. Once you deviate from that perfect center, you become excessive or it gets off center, then everything tumbles. Okay. So it's more about doing it right and keeping it righted rather than letting it get away from you.
It seems to me also that the donkey is probably one of the most important animals in Tanakh. Why? He is subject to Pidyon HaBen. If he has a bechor, you have to turn him out, turn him over to the Kohen. No other animal is used for that, as far as I know.
We're talking about Pidyon HaChamor.
Pidyon HaBen, I mean, the same principle. So I think he's choosing that animal.
Very interesting.
Because it's a special
animal. Very interesting. Okay. Sam, last one.
The common wisdom concerning addiction, that the addict has to fall to the bottom before he can get up. Somehow it kind of clashes with this. Maybe it's, but you think about it, you know, should you wait?
Okay, very nice. Thank you.
Well, maybe because some people won't ask for help, even if they don't realize it, they won't ask.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that if we let this go on, I think we'd get many more responses and keep them coming. But what I want everyone to just sort of take note of is what just happened here. And what just happened here was a rather lengthy conversation on one, two, or three questions. Nechama would send out a gilyon every single week that had about 15 to 20 questions. The whole thing was about 5-6 pages long. And people would sit around their Shabbos tables or whatever context they might find themselves in, and discussing as a group together to try to figure out what in the world, what kind of answer she wants, what is she really looking for. And people would give all sorts of responses. Maybe it has something to do with just a simple understanding, and maybe it's how the donkey can't speak for itself. Or maybe it's talking about Pidyon HaChamor, maybe it's talking about Bilam's donkey. Who knows? But the point is that all of these responses are possible, and Chum is the one who encouraged an entire generation of people to ask questions, to strive towards understanding the text on a much deeper level than we could possibly ever understand it, than just by when we sit in shul on Shabbos morning and read the Torah, when it takes, you know, 20 minutes, the whole thing. It should take hours. That's Nechama's point. We have three psukim here that we read. That's how this section started off. Three psukim. And with three psukim, she could ask 15 questions, and with those 15 questions, you can discuss for hours upon hours, and there are hundreds and thousands of psukim in the Torah. That was what Nechama was all about. Trying to help people see that there is so much more depth to the Torah than is actually right before your eyes. And take a look at source number 11 on page 12. Page 12. Yael Unterman writes, the contents of every worksheet were as follows. Firstly, the student was required to examine the verse, section, or chapter of Scripture carefully, then read the commentaries under discussion, and finally try to answer the questions. Nechama posed which were of the type, what is the difficulty addressed by the commentator, what led the commentator to give additional explanations, what is the difference between one explanation and another, what do the other commentators add, what are the different problems addressed by each of the several commentators on the same verses, what is the weakness of each commentary. Some of the worksheets dealt with specific approaches of particular commentators, especially Rashi. There were also general and linguistic questions which became increasingly diverse as the years went on. Nechama also sometimes added tips, such as articles for further reading for teachers. Nechama wanted to train the students to search for the questions implied in the commentator's words. Her premise, repeated thousands of times over the course of her life, was that commentators did not write for their own pleasure, but were rather responding to difficulties in the text. Nechama reported that the task of pinpointing these difficulties was grueling for her worksheet students, but that the results demonstrate that this task educates towards accurate, healthy, and necessary comprehension. This is what she was all about. 30 years of this. 30 years of every single week writing a new worksheet, and for every single worksheet, a group of people were gathered, and they would spend hours discussing the thousands, the millions of hours probably that were spent collectively by all the people learning because of the Torah that Nechama helped people understand. Not that she gave over, she didn't spit things out of people, except for, of course, she did that a little bit later in life because she was asked and it was made a point for her to do so, but for most of her life, she had people engage in the text in a way that many teachers to this day are not able to do, and that is, of course, what made Nechama so special. Ultimately, Nechama passed away on April 12, 1997, the 5th of Nissan. It was about a month and a half ago or so. It was the 22nd your state of Nachama's as well. Life was just a few months short of her 92nd birthday, but Nachama's legacy still lives on in the sense that to this day, people are still studying her Gilyonot, people are still learning her Torah. I actively use many of her Sfarim just to prepare any sort of weekly drush or anything. She has such insights and such ways of viewing the Pesukim in such a special way that to this day, many of us can still appreciate and learn so much from her. And that's what I think the main call to action is usually. Sometimes we have a message, sometimes we just learn how impressive a person was. But Nechama Leib, what's the message of her life is just to keep learning and keep studying, because there's always something new and something special there. And with that, we will conclude right here. Thank you.